Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to the news with your host, Avenger Satanus, and the Beast.
Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the news. This is T.C. Downey, and with me on the line is my co-host, Avenger Satanus. Avenger, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing pretty extraordinary today, thank you.
Extraordinary, huh? That's a big word, man. Is there something going on that you'd want to share with everybody?
Yeah, I am better than average because I received some better than average news in the mail yesterday after I came home from work. I finally got my letter of acceptance from the IRS stating that the Cult of Cthulhu Incorporated, the nonprofit corporation that I did back a year ago, is now tax exempt. It's officially recognized as like a tax exempt religion by the United States, just like, you know, all the other churches and religions that currently operate, like, you know, Christianity and Judaism and Islam or whatever it is. So the Cult of Cthulhu is now just like them in that regard. We can, you know, have facilities and build on property and not have to pay exorbitant taxes and fees and things like that. We can accept charitable donations that are tax deductible. And, you know, we don't have to pay a lot of income tax on whatever monies the cult brings in. So, yeah, that's very cool. It's a huge step forward, and it's also, you know, a recognition thing, a feather in our cap that we've come this far and we've been recognized as a real religion.
Awesome. And earlier today, you actually stated to me that nothing that's really cool is real, but Cthulhu cult's really cool and it's real, man. So
it is real. It is real. But like anything that is worthwhile or substantial, it doesn't come from the ordinary world. It originated in Lovecraft's mind, his imagination. A lot of it came to him in dreams, and that's where everything worthwhile comes from.
From dreams.
You know, you don't just walk along the ground and, you know, all of a sudden you just see, like, great things like, you know, tentacles or, you know, bags of money or, you know, hot girls just lying on the street waiting to be taken. You know, things like that just don't naturally come about. They're unnatural. And they have to be invented in the minds of men first and then sought after.
Right. My personal philosophy here, well, at least my take on what is religion, is that it all comes to us in the same basic manner in which you're speaking, and that is that, you know, a man dreams it up, he puts it down on a piece of paper, and enough people, you know, put their energy towards it, and that, in fact, solidifies it. It makes it real.
Right.
So I think that's pretty cool, actually. That was one of the things when I originally wrote the description of this show that I wanted to actually talk about was dreams. a little bit. Before we actually get into our main character, I kind of just want to make a little bit of my case on that whole deal, and that is that, you know, Aleister Crowley, it's a Midwestern accent that forces me to do that. Aleister Crowley, he actually came in his mind to the concept of thelema through a daydream, where his newlywed wife and him had taken a honeymoon, and they went down to Egypt, and they went into the great pharaoh's tomb, and they fornicated all over the place and everything. And while they were in there, I guess his wife at that time had become possessed, and she kept repeating a phrase that annoyed him over and over again. And so he stopped and he asked her to tell, him what she was seeing, and he couldn't believe when she said Horus, he couldn't believe that his ears, because she was ignorant to the occult lifestyle and to other religions, which he then needed proof. So he took her to an Egyptian museum, supposedly, and she went directly straight to the exhibit for Horus, which happened to be exhibit number 666 at the time. And, and she said, this guy, this is the one. And after that, they retired to their room, and it was in their room that voices began to whisper to him as he started to write out the Book of the Law. Now, that's the, the account that's given as to how Crowley came into this information. So, with all of these thoughts in mind, I guess we could continue to talk about something that actually was what Lovecraft referred to as the worst nightmare that he had had since he was a boy 10 years of age. And that would be Nyarlathotep. Mm-hmm.
Can you go into that dream somewhat, or?
The only statement I've actually found on it, and I have to go back over it, this was in a letter in 1921 to Reinhard Kleiner. Lovecraft basically described that the dream was the most realistic and horrible nightmare he'd experienced since he was a 10-year-old boy. And it ended up serving as the basis for his prose poem, which, ironically enough, is entitled Nyarlathotep. Mm-hmm. But there's not really a description, so I'm assuming that the poem itself is meant to be the description.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I keep... I'm definitely going to order... there's a new edition of S.T. Joshi's biography on Lovecraft. It's called Lovecraft, A Life. And Hippocampus Press has like a brand new, like two-volume set of that. And I'm going to order that because I've been meaning to read it for a long, long time, ever since the first Cthulhu 1 convention way back in 2005. When S.T. Joshi is one of the guest speakers, was talking about it. And I was amazed then they didn't bring copies of his biography, which had either just been published or just been reprinted like a year before. And so I never got a chance. I still haven't. I'm just way behind in my reading, I guess. I plan on reading his biography of Lovecraft because that's bound to be really insightful. I read Sprague Dukamp's biography on Lovecraft back in high school, but that's not as accurate, I think, or as in-depth as Joshi's. So anyway, that's just a side tangent.
Right. Well, before we really get into the meat and potatoes of everything today, let me throw out our call-in number. It's 347-989-1371. And I will be periodically coming back to the switchboard, obviously, to look and see if anybody's calling in. So if you guys are trying to get in, just hang on the line and listen to the show for a few minutes, and no doubt I'll be back. And I'm more than happy to let you on and talk to us a little bit about this. I think that this deity is probably the most unique deity in all of Lovecraft's work. He's different from all the rest of them in the fact that rather than, you know, being trapped under the sea or locked out of this universe or hidden in a mountain somewhere, he's actually walking amongst us, or at least
right.
Embodiments of him.
Right. I've got a little bit of a quote here I'd like to read for a second. It's from The Dreams in the Witch House, by H.P. Lovecraft, of course. There was the immemorial figure of the deputy or messenger of hidden and terrible powers, the black man of the witch cult, and the Nyarlathotep of the Necronomicon. That's it. But there's a lot of different pieces in Lovecraft's writing and other mythos works where Nyarlathotep takes a certain form in whatever culture or society and influences mankind, preys upon different things, human weakness and frailty, etc., to get what he wants, to change maybe the course of human evolution and different sorcerers and black magicians use Nyarlathotep to gain power.
Right. What I actually think is really fascinating about Nyarlathotep is I'm still getting used to saying that word. One of the things that I think is most interesting about him is that rather than being out for like total destruction and blood and guts and gore, he's more into like psychological play. He wants to drive people completely insane. That's like his deal. That's why they call him Crawling Chaos, from my understanding. Because
mm-hmm.
he's out there to fuck with you.
Right. Yeah. I see him as more of a finesse man than really, like really a powerhouse of destruction and all that. 1 second.
Sure.
Come on, phone. Yeah, just take it, whatever.
Yep.
Sorry about that.
Hey, that's we're all actually living real lives while we're doing this, so.
Yeah. I had some stuff, like, thrown out on the curb, and apparently someone pulled up in my driveway wanting to take it and wanted to ask me questions about it, but I told them on the phone, just take it.
Yeah. Something I read, and I believe it was actually you that wrote it in the Cthulhu Cult Bible, it was that Nyarlathotep, he was actually a servant of Azathoth.
Uh-huh.
Azathoth, that's it. Azathoth. Sorry, I'm still getting used to actually pronouncing these things out loud, so.
That's okay. I mean, there's no real correct pronunciation. I mean, people pronounce this, you know, wildly different all the time. So,
well, he's actually a dedicated servant to Azathoth, and I think that's really cool because you don't really see much allegiance throughout the Lovecraft mythos, at least not that I've seen so far.
That's true. A lot of gods kind of work on their own. But then again, the whole allegiance to Azathoth is probably one person's interpretation. And even Lovecraft himself, in one story, he presents, you know, a certain god in one way. And then in another story, or even a different passage within the same story, he'll have like a slightly different spin or a subtle variation on what he was just talking about somewhere else. So, and I think Lovecraft did that intentionally, sort of, you know, create a buoyancy of verisimilitude to his works. You know, if you just describe something as one way, then it only has half the life of something that is described in multiple ways, whether various conflicts within the paradigm or within the concept itself. So it lends it more credence and substance, I think.
I would agree with you, actually. In my opinion, I think the dualities that are presented and the contradictions, you know, they tend to breathe more life into the actual understanding of the character because, you know, I don't think anything in this universe really has one mindset. There's always those conflicting thoughts that are chasing through. So I guess that's my interpretation of this is, you know, that the... Fuck, there we go, I lost it. No, my interpretation of this is that, you know, given the dynamic and different angles of things gives you the ability to get a fuller understanding of what you're dealing with less words.
Uh-huh. Right. I talked to you earlier in the week. One of my references to Nyarlathotep is not actually from Lovecraft or another mythos writer, but it's from this role-playing, the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, like a big scenario book, which is a book of like adventures that characters can go on in this game. It's called Masks of Nyarlathotep. And the whole giant campaign, which some people have reported played weekly for 2 years of their life, like going through like the entirety of this book and all these adventures. So it's huge, and it spans the entire world. You can start out from New York and then go to London and Egypt and Mombasa and Cairo and Shanghai, even Australia. So it's giant. But anyway, the stuff that the author came up with for Masks of Nyarlathotep is really something. It's really extraordinary. It really develops the character of Nyarlathotep beyond what Lovecraft first envisioned. And a lot of times when authors do that, I think they really screw it up and they, you know, they do too much and they give away too much. You know, anytime that you say things about the god that that kind of makes it less mysterious or less powerful or I don't know. Anytime you give a god a middle name, that kind of almost ruins it in a way. But the way that he did it, it just sort of, it really transcends the whole character of Nyarlathotep. He's got many different forms, and there's different cults from different sections of the world that follow him. There's the cult of the bloody tongue from Africa, and then there's the order of the bloated woman, I believe, from Shanghai. And just a ton. So anyway, that's one of my reference points. Maybe I can find a quote in a minute here, that's it.
actually, I guess we should really, you know, give an idea of some of the ways that that this actually manifests. More so than not, he either arrives as a more modern, tall, thin man who resembles an Egyptian pharaoh, or he is manifested as an Egyptian pharaoh. Now, there are some supernatural entities that are described, like in The Haunter of the Dark, he's described as a a single eye with three lobes, and then what was it? Tentacles in the back.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and actually look real quick, but I think it's fascinating because you don't see a lot of that in Lovecraft's work, where the actual deities are manifesting as men themselves. The closest that I can think is the hybrid Wilbur Whately.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, Lovecraft used that with the gods coming down and mixing with humans and spawning hybrids of their own kind. That's used throughout those. I found a good quote here at the beginning of Masks of Nyarlathotep. Let me just read this. This is a summary of events, and then I'll get to a quote. In the year 1916, Kenyan cultists hold an obscene ritual dedicated to the god of the bloody tongue. Weru, a beautiful Kikuyu girl, has been priestess of the cult since her 14th birthday. The ritual has never caused the god to appear, but this day is different. As the priestess whirled around the firelit circle, chanting dim words from an ancient spell, the cult executioners busied themselves with their screaming sacrifices. As the blood flowed, a chill wind sprang up, and I felt a flash of fear. The wind had become visible, a black vapor against the gibbous, leering moon, and slowly my terror grew as I comprehended the monstrous thing taking form. The corrosive stench of it hinted at vileness beyond evil. When I saw the great red appendage, which alone constituted the face of the thing, my courage died, and I fled unseeing into the night. And that's from the fictitious tome by Nigel Blackwell called Africa's Dark Sects.
Africa's Dark Sects, huh?
Yeah. Sects is in, like sect of the bloody tongue.
Yeah, like S-E-C-T-S.
Yeah, exactly. The whole scenario book of Masks of Nyarlathotep is just peppered with little tidbits like that. That really, Lovecraft himself could have written something like that, and it's just as powerful. So for me, that's a great resource on Nyarlathotep. I've also ran the Masks of Nyarlathotep campaign twice in its entirety, and then once or twice, just bits and pieces. So I'm very familiar with it, and I love it, not only as the high priest of the Cthulhu cult, but as a role player that just likes gaming in the worlds of Lovecraft.
Some events have actually happened since our last show that were fascinating. For instance, Sci-Fi premiered a new rendition of the Dunwich Horror.
That premiered the day after our last show, so last Sunday.
Right, last Sunday it premiered, and I had a chance to sit down and watch the whole thing, and I thought it was excellent. I saw some pretty negative reviews, but I thought it was probably one of the better renditions of books that I've seen in my life. When they make their transition to cinema, they tend to lose a lot of the core stuff that the author was actually going at. And even though this didn't, follow the storyline, I think that it caught a lot of Lovecraft concepts that are maybe forgotten.
Right. Yeah, I think following a particular storyline is really anecdotal to the whole, adding to the mythos thing. It's really unnecessary. Sure, it's great to see a very faithful adaptation of, a story that Lovecraft wrote with, a lot of using the exact quotes that Lovecraft does. And, so basically you can see what he wrote, on the screen. But, we can do that just by reading it. So I'm actually more fascinated by someone that takes the ideas or the central image of what Lovecraft was trying to do, and then they do their own thing with it. They create their own story and have it go in a completely different direction. So I admire that, and I think when it comes to film and TV, you almost have to do that, because, you know.
Right, otherwise all you're doing is just giving people a lazy way out of reading.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You're reciting the same thing. You're parroting it back. You know, where's the freshness and the originality? You know, where's your own contribution to the mythos? I mean, that's what authors and artists should be asking themselves, and filmmakers, all the time. You know, where is my contribution to the mythos? How do I add to this rich tapestry of Lovecraft's cosmic horror? So yeah, I really loved the new Dunwich Horror, and I think that it was a success. And hopefully we'll bring more people into the fold, more people aware of not only H.P. Lovecraft, but the Cthulhu cults, which we are a part of. And, you know, only good things can come from that. So, huzzah, Sci-Fi Channel and the Dunwich Horror.
Okay. Now, one of the things, and the reason I brought this up in the first place, one of the things that I thought was really cool that's not actually in the story at all, but when Wilbur Whitley was on his quest for page 751, and he couldn't find it, and he asked where the original was, and well, of course, you know, the one character, he says, well, I'll go with you to help you, while the other two are out there. You know, they're trying to actually find the original. And they come after a series of hallucinations induced by some weird liquid that they drank. They come to the realization that the original doesn't exist because it was pulled from a dream.
Right.
And I think that that's what's really cool about all of this stuff, is that Lovecraft recognizes that what you dream of manifests in real life.
Right.
And so, again, that ties into the whole deal of, you know, something has to be dreamed up and then, you know, given power before it can become reality. I think that that, in essence, is what magic is all about, correct?
Right. Yeah, I would definitely say so. I think a person's subjective reality is just as important, if not more so, than the consensual objective reality that ordinary people conceive of every day and live in. I think a person's own personal reality can be much stronger and have much more of an impact and influence on the world than people would assume.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've seen proof of it with Buddhist monks, focusing, on being extremely hot to the point where they actually combust.
Right. Yeah. There's a great documentary. Some people that are really science based and not. But not open-minded. I really panned this documentary. But it's called What the Bleep Do We Know? I can't remember if we've talked about it or if you've seen it.
Not actually on the air, but you and I have talked about it before.
Okay.
A little bit. What the bleep do we know?
Yeah, it goes into not only quantum physics and string theory, but a lot of other things related to that. But the gist is that consciousness can have an appreciable and empirical effect on reality. If you think about things and you focus on them and concentrate, focusing and concentrating your consciousness on something in particular, that will have a measurable effect on reality. It changes things. It changes little random things around whatever it is. It can change the molecular structure of something, something like a snowflake or just the atoms in a glass of water or whatever. And then you add that, over time, And then you add more people and more consciousness of trying to change something, and you can definitely alter reality. It's been proven that consciousness alone can alter reality, and that's the basis of black magic, and that's the basis of what we do.
Absolutely. Now, there's actually, this same scenario is actually posed to us in The Haunter in the Dark. The character Blake, I believe his name was, Robert Blake?
Yes.
He is a fiction writer himself. And, you know, he's sitting in his house and he's staring out the window, and far away across the horizon he can see the shadowings of what appears to be a church. And so, you know, he intently begins to fantasize that you know, this church could be, you know, it could be abandoned, it could hold some dark secret, you know, and you're given the impression that perhaps the events that follow in this story that happen after this they're manifested by him. And even though it's never said that, that is, you know, one of the ways that I looked at it as I was reading it was, you know, if he had not fixated on the structure and given it, you know, credibility in his mind, would he have been drawn to it, and would he have come across Nyarlathotep?
Right.
Now, I think this is further symbolized in the story by the shining, trapezoid something or another. I can't think of what they call it.
The shining trapezohedron?
Yeah, that's it. I know that sounds retarded not to know how to say the words, but I know what I'm looking at when I'm reading it, so that's really all that's important to me. And I'm trying to learn to express it to everybody that we're talking to. This is kind of a new deal for me, you know, to actually sit and examine these things openly where everybody can listen. And I get a little bit nervous. I hope that's understandable for everybody. But anyway, I think that stone that attracts and draws them to it, that is actually symbolic of what I'm suggesting, that it's all being manifested from his imagination to start with.
Right.
And he just grows to obsess upon it.
Exactly.
And you know, the question at the end of the story is, you know, is he sitting there dead with a look of sheer terror on his face because Nyarlathotep actually came across the darkness and got him? Or did he scare himself to death, worrying that this is what happened?
Right. Yeah, there's definitely some ambiguity there. And I think one of the essences of the mythos is obsession. And I think that's an important part of almost every Lovecraftian protagonist is their obsession about the mythos and about what's occurring, what may be going on beneath the shadows, things like that.
Excellent. B, I've got to take this other phone call real quick, man. So,
that's no problem. Actually, go ahead. I've got another quote that I want to read. And that's from, that's also from The Mask of Nyarlathotep. It's a little passage from a book that the characters can find.
Okay.
Kind of at the beginning of the story. It's called Life as a God. An excerpt from the handwritten diary of Montgomery Crompton. Its angles were magnificent and most strange. By their hideous beauty, I was enraptured and enthralled. And I thought myself of the daylight fools who adjudged the housing of this room as mistaken. I laughed for the glory they missed. And the six lights lit and the great word said, then he came. In all the grace and splendor of the higher plane. And I longed sever my veins, so that my life might flow into his being and make part of me a god. But I think things like that, you know, just little tidbits here and there are just so powerful. And and explorative. They just add to the mythos. They add to the reality, not only of the role-playing game, you know, but the mythos in general. And the Cthulhu cult uses the Cthulhu mythos as, you know, a jumping-off point for reality. You know, we choose to believe that these things are real, and that makes them real to us, and belief is reality to us. So, yeah, and it's just like the movie In the Mouth of Madness, and as we talked about, the documentary on quantum physics and whatnot called What the Bleep Do We Know, and there's a book called The Holographic Universe, which is very good. All the books written about chaos magic is about turning personal belief into a personal reality. So I would recommend all of those things. Also, if people haven't read book one of our Bible, which is simply called Cthulhu Cult, you can order it from me direct, or you can get it on Amazon or Lulu.com. But I'm also very willing to email anyone a free PDF if they just go to the website, find my email address, and ask me. Just ask me for it, and there it is. And book two of our Bible, Liber AO, which is basically Book of the Ancient Ones, is already on our website, just plain text with pictures. So I encourage people to come and read that too and let me know what they think. You know, write a review, post a video on YouTube, you know, start a discussion somewhere in some other forum. You know, do what you got to do. It's time for communication. So I hope people will communicate with me and with my co-host TC and the rest of the cults and the rest of the Left Hand Path community.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that makes the Cthulhu cult stand out amongst its peers is that its subjectivity is it's much more pliable than most of the other philosophies out there.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. It's very non-dogmatic, and it's very open-ended. But at the same time, we have definite principles and definite techniques for getting what we want out of life that we put into practice. But just like anything, it's subject to revision, and we love to have more information from different perspectives, more life stories that people can relate and help us out, and maybe we can add to someone else's reality. That's always good. So,
absolutely. Sorry about that breakaway there. It sounds like seemed like you were filling it up pretty good with information. Maybe the trick here is to let you just blab for about an hour. And
well, no, I would run out, so that's why it's good to have a co-host. speaking of which, the next show that we're doing, we talked about it a little bit, and it's basically going to be generally on ritual magic. I know we both have a lot to say on that, and we're going to try to get someone else to help us talk about that and add to the discussion. Maybe one of our cultists, or if she can't do it, then maybe someone else. So we could be working on that.
We're actually we're still outside of the undiluted truth part, but I think we've kind of deviled into Naira Lapatop as much as you can really do without people actually taking the time to read all these different texts that include the character. And so why don't we
and
just
without
go
people calling in. So hopefully next week, you know, when the discussion is probably a little bit more easy for a novice or someone that's not steeped in Lovecraft's mythos to, you know, jump on the bandwagon and add to this discussion. But yeah, people should call in because, you know, not only does it pad out the show and help us out, but I think it definitely adds to the discussion. So hopefully people will call in next week. Too bad they didn't call in this week. I guess there's still time.
Yeah, there is. The number's 347-989-1371. If you want to call in, or open it up for the last 19 minutes of the show here, and we'll talk about just about anything, you know. Doesn't have to relate to today's topic. I know we've got at least 4 live listeners right now, and it'd be nice if you guys gave us a little bit of a hand and called in and, you know, gave us a little bit of perspective. Maybe tell us how you're enjoying the show, you know, if you're enjoying the show. Let us know if, you know, you think we could have come at it at a different angle. If there's something in particular that you guys want us to talk about in the future, we're obviously we're taking a break from our series on the old ones, and you know we're going to move into black magic as or ritual magic as Avenger already outlined for you guys. That by itself should be extremely fascinating. So I expect to see some callers next week.
Right, me too. Oh, one last thing about Night Office that we talked about on our own a few days ago, but I don't know if we mentioned it today, and that's the link between Nyarlathotep and Satan, or the devil. I think more than any other old one, Nyarlathotep personifies the devil in the fact that he tempts man, and he can become physical, like take on a physical form on Earth and go out to different people and influence them and tempt them. That's just his deal. That passage from the Dreams in the Witch House talked about, you know, not only is Nyarlathotep in the Necronomicon, but he's known as the Black Man to the witch cults, and I would presume that that Satanism would see Nyarlathotep as Satan. Would you agree?
Absolutely, I would think that if there was a single deity from Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos that embodied Satan, I would say that this is definitely the main runner-up.
Right. And this just occurred to me that Nyarlathotep is probably the closest in maybe not appearance or personality, but on some level he's more akin to humanity than the other old ones. I mean, I think Yog-Sothoth and Cthulhu are just so extra-dimensional and unknown, just, you know, weird and inconceivable, that they're truly alien. But Nyarlathotep, I think, maybe has a closer lineage to mankind than the other old ones.
Right. Well, if you follow the Cthulhu mythos, then you obviously know that the concept here is that they... Before they were imprisoned, they, shall we say, they demonically possessed man with the ability to, you know, have a soul. And that's kind of the same deal as the Christian explanation for, you know, what Satan's function is.
That's true. Yeah, the whole, Lucifer and Prometheus and that whole myth cycle. Nyarlathotep is, I think he's also mentioned as not only the messenger, but the soul of the group of ones. So in that way, you know, maybe Nyarlathotep is also like the serpent from the Garden of Eden. He initiates man into the struggle between good and evil and knowing the difference. And he gives man a choice, and he's sort of the spiritual elements whereby we can recognize the great old ones. Maybe that's the case.
good possibility. Let me, again, I'm going to throw out there the 347-989-1371. Give us a call. We still got 14 minutes left in the show. One of the things that I thought...
Stuff?
Or, what's or that?
Do you want to talk about... Or do you want to go to our commercial ad stuff? Or do you want
to... Yeah, let's do the commercial break. And when we come back, I'd actually like to maybe devil just a little bit into Azathoth.
Okay.
There's an observation that I've made as I've been reading through all these different mythos, some of them for, you know, the third or fourth time, and some of them for the very first time. And I'd definitely like to discuss it with you. So let's throw the commercials up, and then when we come back, we'll get into Azathoth.
The Ooze is brought to you by the following. CultOfCthulhu.net. Awaken with the Cult of Cthulhu. CreativeOddityStudios.com. Making art a dirty word since 1998. Lulu.com/Satanus. Purchase publishings by Avenger Satanus. Artist, author, cult visionary. Find titles such as Cthulhu Cult, Libre.io, and the role-playing game Empire of Satanus. Lulu.com/CreativeOddities. Find publishings written by Jason Sorrell, artist, author, such as The Tattoo Apprentice, The Baphomet Codex, and The Devil's Due. FearTheBeast.com. Let the madness begin. Catch the dollars. A vigilant of vision. YouTube.com/HighPriestSatanus. Now back to our program.
All right, we're back.
Oh, yeah.
I was trying real quick here to look on Wiki to make sure I got my story correct, but the commercial only lasts about a minute, so I didn't get to it. But I believe it was The Haunter in the Dark, where Azathoth is actually mentioned as being the blind idiot god.
I think that description probably occurs in a couple different stories. I know the Dreams in the Witch House also mentions Azathoth. The demon salt chaos who sits on his throne in the middle of the void and has very certain servants playing the flute and dancing around, you know, and in an idiotic kind of mambo or whatever.
Right. Now, my understanding of this is that Azathoth is he's being kept asleep by these pipers and these drummers.
Oh, okay.
And
that makes sense.
And that is actually why he's blind to everything that's going on, because the lesser gods they tricked him by having these pipers and drummers put him to sleep so that they could come and imprison the old ones so that they could have rule over the earth. Mm. And now my observation of this is it kind of falls in line with a lot of the atheist thinking. If there is a god, he's blind or sleeping, or he has a sick sense of humor.
Right.
And that fact that it's kind of an explanation for why the all-powerful being isn't keeping things in its right order.
Right. Yeah, I think most people would, even hardcore Christians, would have to believe that things are pretty fucked up in the world. This is a world of suffering and that man lives in. And, I mean, logically, it doesn't make sense either. You know, if God is all-powerful and all-knowing and all-good, then how can he let evil exist in the world, especially run so rampant over his creation and his children? So it begs the question, isn't God either not powerful enough to stop the evil, or is God himself evil and he just doesn't give a fuck about humanity suffering and the rest of the world? and he's powerful enough to stop it. He just doesn't want to.
Right. I mean, that may well be the case, but I think that I would subscribe to the sleeping theory.
Well, I believe that there are many different kinds of gods, and there are different forces. There's one kind of force that usually holds sway over the world, that to a large extent created the world, the demiurge kind of deity, like the old school Jehovah. And that god is more or less hostile to humanity and wants to keep us in a prison. It wants to, it feeds upon our suffering, because suffering is the one universal concept throughout the world. But then there are other, and that those are the lesser gods. But then there are, the other gods, the great old ones, the ancient ones, that not only helped mankind to evolve to his present state, but they actually encapsulate the spiritual element and a way out. And they're sleeping just as humanity sleeps, but they can affect us, and we can call to them, and we can influence and help each other, the great old ones and mankind, and until we're both free. And those are a different kind of god, not usually accessible to ordinary man, but it's possible. There's potential there. And those are the gods that can really help us and really have our well-being at heart.
Right. Well, there's, from what I read on Wiki about this whole ordeal, and, it may be incorrect, but I'm assuming that all the information on there is kept correct because it works in a system of checks and balances, where if someone sees something that's not factual, they can challenge it and then ultimately rewrite it. But what I saw was that, in fact, we all came from what is referred to as the Source. The Source, it was the father of Azathoth, and that's why he's the, he's the big kahuna. He's the one that's held captive in the, as it was put, nuclear the nuclear sphere in the stars, where the center, everything orbits around Azathoth.
Right.
And it was actually, as I said, a trick that these pipers keep him sleeping so that these lesser gods can run rampant. And they're allowed to run rampant by the Source because they kneel to him and pretty much kiss his ass, is what I read. Where the old ones, they were champions of rebellion and challenge, and they believed in freedom and free will, which obviously any man can rationally draw the conclusion that if everything was allowed to be completely free, there would be nothing but chaos and mayhem.
Right. Perhaps that's, that's the utopia that Lovecraft envisioned, where everyone can follow their true will in some sort of maybe dark, sick harmony that doesn't make sense to us, but is full of chaos. And I don't know, it's hard to envision, but there's definitely something going on.
So, anyway, my analysis was, I just thought it was interesting how this god was subdued to sleep. And I'm assuming that the lesser gods, as they're referred to, are the ones that are currently worshipped across the world.
Right. Those would be the ones worshipped by the white light religions and the mainstream churches throughout the globe.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's only the sects and cults and orders that are that operate in secret, away from the prying eyes, and that are somewhat forbidden and demonized. Those are the ones that are really trying to reach some deeper and fundamental, not only in themselves and reality, but you know, across spiritual dimensions into astral space. You know, contacting deities that can actually do something for them and actually, you know, give a shit about the world and the suffering in it, and the individual black magician.
Right. Now, I've seen on some levels people try to put together mass ritual, but I think it'd be absolutely fantastic if we could, you know, unite everybody under one ritual, one observation, one day, one holiday that's our own, you know, and I don't mean one that's been outlined before, as of anything that's, you know, anything that's actually worth having, as you said, all the cool stuff is not real. You know, it needs to be a day that doesn't have any significance right now.
Right. Yeah, everything worthwhile is not real, but you have to make it real. That's the point. You have to put yourself into it. You have to put in the work. You have to do the work. You have to be active. I know we talk about this all the time on the show. You know, you can't just sit idly by day after day and just hope that awesome things come to you and that, you know, the movement is going to start, you know, on its own, you know, without you helping out.
Right.
People have to do their part.
I mean, it really comes down to the basic concept. If you're thirsty and there's a glass of water sitting in front of you, no matter what, you either have to do the work of convincing someone else to pour that glass of water down your throat, or you have to do the work of lifting the glass and drinking yourself.
Right. And sometimes, you know, is it easier to magically levitate the glass of water over to you and you know, tip it up and then drink if it's liquidy goodness, or is it easier to just walk over to the glass and pick it up yourself and then just start drinking? You know, if it's easy to do something in the real world, you know, just pick up the phone or email something to someone or you know, or make a video or spread someone else's word, spread a video or a PDF or something like that. Then, you know, make it happen. You don't actually have to go in the ritual chamber every week to get shit done. You can just, you know, let your fingers do the walking. Just go do whatever and make a difference. You know, it's not that hard.
All right. Well, we've reached that portion of the show, man, where we need to take a quick second and just say thanks to everybody who's listening to us and all the people who have been supporting us. Our archives are still way up there in number, so I mean, people are coming out to listen to what we have to say, and although we're harping on you for getting active, at least you're taking the effort to, you know, take a listen. Venture, I want to say thank you to you for you know, of course, giving the inspiration for all of this. And
thank you, Beast, for you know, allowing me to do this show with you, because I think the ooze is something extraordinary, and it's definitely taking things in new directions, and it's helping the whole left hand path out.
Absolutely.
Now, as you know, I see it like 6 months from now. I think it's gonna grow. It's gonna get bigger. And it's just going to become more awesome.
Absolutely. I think as we research every week for these shows and dig deeper and deeper into things, a lot of new things are going to come to light, and I think you're actually going to triple in our value.
I hope so. Yeah. Watch my videos on YouTube, people. Just find me on High Priest Satanus on YouTube. And I got a lot of videos. Watch them, comments, you know, favorite, subscribe, all that stuff.
All right. I think that's it, man, unless you got anything else.
Nope, done.
All right, we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily reflect those held by Venture or Beast or any institution associated with us. The Ooze does not condone any illegal or unethical acts. If you have been offended during the production of the show, we're sorry, but as the old expression goes, tough luck. Thank you, and see you next week.